We have lots of birds who are migrating all kind of places in the world. So this problem could be not just local problem, it could be global problem.
Concerns over what gets released when permafrost melts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a cruise ship full of wealthy travelers didn't add up to much for Nome vendors.
Even some of the smaller items, I didn't get the impression people were buying that they could take home, like smaller items of jams or jellies.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The Alaska Division of Elections is still working to certify the results of the House race for the district that includes North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs. Division Director Josie Banky says the division's office in Juneau is waiting for the ballots to be mailed in from four precincts in District 40, Selawik, Browerville, Anaktuvik Pass, and Ambler. Banky says the Election Review Board was aiming to certify the results on Monday, but that action is delayed until the division receives all of the ballots. Banky says she still expects to certify the results by Friday.
Right now, it's just a matter of the mail service.
Dean Westlake leads incumbent Representative Benjamin Nagiak by 21 votes, according to the last vote count. The trailing candidate or 10 qualified voters will have 5 days after the review is completed to ask for a recount. Russian officials say warming permafrost could be linked to a deadly anthrax outbreak in Siberia this month. Permafrost can be found in a lot of Alaska, from the Arctic coast to Anchorage. But at least one expert isn't alarmed about the potential for thawing ground to bring old diseases back to life. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has the story.
After a Siberian heat wave, anthrax hit the Yamal Peninsula in early August. The bacterial disease has claimed the life of a child and thousands of reindeer. Permafrost expert Vladimir Romanovsky of the University of Alaska Fairbanks says melting permafrost and erosion may have worked together to spread anthrax into the water supply.
Thawing of permafrost can release microorganisms first into the active layer, then into water and air, which were sequestered there for many, many years, tens of years, and even thousands and tens of thousands of years.
Romanovsky says scientists have talked about the possibility of epidemics caused by thawing permafrost. But until now, it's only been a theory. If the Siberian anthrax outbreak is traced back to spores in the permafrost, it would be a troubling development.
This release of this dangerous microorganism could actually be spread very easily from the north, because we have lots of birds who are migrating all kind of places in the world. So this problem could be not just local problem, it could be global problem.
Romanovsky says more research is needed to tie this anthrax outbreak to warming permafrost. Dr. David Morins is an infectious disease specialist with the National Institutes of Health. He's not worried about anthrax or any other disease surfacing from the ground. He says anthrax is hardy, and it's virtually everywhere.
Anthrax is sitting in the grass in farms in Texas, and it's in Asia, it's in Africa, it's everywhere. And so the fact that some might be in the permafrost doesn't really add to whatever the risk is.
Although anthrax is widespread, the chance of getting sick from it is really small, and the likelihood of contracting anthrax from spores exhumed from the permafrost, even tinier. Morins has studied the 1918 Spanish influenza pandemic that decimated rural villages in Alaska. Brevig Mission was hit especially hard. Spanish flu killed 90% of the village over the course of 6 days. The remains of the victims were buried together. A team of researchers has used samples from that mass grave to reconstruct the genetic code of the virus. But Morin says Alaskans shouldn't be afraid of getting sick as the ground in Brevik Mission thaws. He says unlike anthrax, Spanish flu is very fragile.
What came out of the so-called permafrost was just broken pieces of RNA, nucleic acid. There was nothing infectious. A ton of it swallowed would have been harmless.
Freezing and thawing breaks up viruses like Spanish flu, killing them.
So if we're talking about viruses and deadly things, I would say that for all intents and purposes, whatever might be there in the permafrost is not going to be contagious.
Morin's doesn't fear viruses or bacteria emerging from their cryogenic slumber, but he is concerned about the threat of new diseases.
All these emerging viruses that keep coming on, Zika and chikungunya and SARS and all that, it's not that they're being created. It's not that they're being dug up from the permafrost. It's that they're already there. And we human beings do things that kind of invite them to come in and infect us and cause epidemics.
Officials in Russia are trying to stop the anthrax outbreak from spreading further. They are incinerating all infected reindeer carcasses and have banned hunting in the region. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
A search that tapped air and ground resources ended successfully last night when an overdue hiker was rescued in the wilderness near Chena Hot Springs Resort east of Fairbanks. Alaska State Troopers report 19-year-old Anatoly Belko was spotted from the air and picked up by helicopter. Belko works at Chena Hot Springs and left the resort for a 30-mile hike early Friday. A search was initiated when he did not show up for work Sunday morning. Belko, who recently moved from Alaska to Alaska from Washington, lost the trail, and troopers say he used a makeshift flag to signal rescuers. Chena Hot Springs owner Bernie Carl says he plans to buy several satellite tracking devices to loan to resort staff and guests headed into the backcountry.
They're GPS, and you can punch a button, and we're going to know where you're at, and we can go, we can get you some help. You don't know what's going to happen when you're out there.
Carl says he also recommends people not travel alone. John Schaefer Jr., an Inupiat Eskimo elder and tribal leader in Northwest Alaska, has died. He was 77. Schaefer was the first president and CEO of the Nana Regional Corporation. Nana Chief Operating Officer Lori Henry says Schaefer died August 25th in Kotzebue, his hometown. He will be buried in Kotzebue tomorrow following a memorial service at the high school gym. A cause of death was not disclosed. Schaefer joined the Alaska Army National Guard's Eskimo Scout Battalion in 1957, serving as the Adjutant General of the Alaska National Guard starting in the mid-1980s until 1991. Guard officials say he was among the leaders in the state's response to the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Earlier this month, Schaefer attended a dedication of a Guard hangar named after him in Kotzebue. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, improving the safety of seal oil.
Now we know how we can most likely guarantee that there won't be a botulism incident if they follow these particular steps.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
Anchorage police have released the name of a second man who was found dead in a local park over the weekend. Police say 34-year-old Kevin Turner of Anchorage was one of two homicide victims found early Sunday morning at Valley of the Moon Park. Police have identified the other man as 25-year-old Bryant DeHewson of Anchorage. Police spokeswoman Renee Olstead says no one has been arrested. Police are declining to say how the men died. Police say they were called to the scene shortly before 2 a.m. Sunday after one of the bodies was found on the bike path. Officers found the other man's body in the park nearby as they were searching the area. An old-growth timber sale recently announced in a Ketchikan newspaper has one conservation group scratching its head. That's because this type of harvest near valuable salmon streams won't be allowed in the future. The U.S. Forest Service is working on a new timber plan in the Tongass National Forest, which is expected to be finalized by winter. In the meantime, forest managers are moving ahead with timber sales under the old rules. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Recently in the Ketchikan Daily News, along with cars for sale and apartments for rent, an ad appeared. The Forest Service was looking for a buyer for 866 acres of old-growth trees on North QU Island.
Yeah, no one would know about it unless you're, you know, reading the back pages of the Ketchikan papers.
Austin Williams says he learned about it from a Trout Unlimited member in Ketchikan. Williams is the director of law and policy for the organization. And he says what troubles him about the timber sale is where it's slated to happen.
Right in the middle of some of the most valuable and important fish and wildlife habitat in the region.
It's known as the Tongass 77, an area that serves as a major watershed. Williams says logging can cause erosion, creating problems for spawning salmon. Just a few years ago, the Forest Service repaired streams on QU damaged by timber harvest from the 1970s, back when there were no regulated buffers along salmon streams. That's changed, and this particular sale went through an environmental assessment and a public comment period before becoming final 8 years ago.
But there's been no opportunity for public involvement since the decision came out in 2008. And, you know, a lot has changed since then.
One major change, soon sales like this won't be possible. The Forest Service is about to come out with an amended timber plan for the Tongass. And old-growth logging in these watershed areas won't be allowed. But Jason Anderson, a deputy forest supervisor, says sales that have already been approved, like the one on QU, can move forward.
We would not have necessarily crafted this sale under the new plan, but we're also operating, you know, that we're in that changeover period.
Anderson says the QU sale is happening now because the market conditions are right, and he's not sure how many outstanding timber sales exist like this. He thinks, compared to the overall size of the QU sale, the trees in the watershed area represent a relatively small percentage.
And while I can recognize the concerns that are out there, I think on the whole, the transition spells out how a lot of this will occur in terms of bringing forward more young growth over time, being very deliberate about what old growth is offered in that time frame, and again, considering and protecting those watersheds that have the highest fisheries value to the region.
The Forest Service approved the QU timber for export. That means the trees aren't likely to go to local mills, but Owen Graham says he's okay with that. He's the executive director of the Alaska Forest Association, a timber industry group. He says the QU sale is made up of a lot of hemlock, a low-value timber.
Those chips used to go to the pulp mill. Now they have to be barged 800 miles south as well. And so it's the economics of trying to harvest timber and manufacture it on a remote, high-cost island like QU is pretty difficult.
Difficult because there are no pulp mills left in southeast Alaska. And Graham says the Forest Service's red tape doesn't make it any more cost-effective for domestic buyers. Still, he thinks the QU Island timber sale is significant for the logging jobs it does keep in the region. But Austin Williams, from Trout Unlimited, says the public should have another say before old-growth trees are cut down in a watershed.
You know, one of the great things about southeast Alaska is that largely our fisheries are intact and our watersheds and streams are healthy and productive, and we have incredibly abundant salmon runs. But if we don't take care of those, you know, we risk to lose them.
The objection period on the amended Tongass plan ends this week. The Forest Service is accepting bids for the QU Island timber sale until September 13th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Many birch leaves in Fairbanks and Anchorage are going from green to brown as the result of an insect infestation. U.S. Forest Service entomologist Stephen Burr in Fairbanks says a leaf mining bug believed to have come to the state on imported ornamental trees is to blame.
The ember-marked birch leaf miner, it's an invasive sawfly, which is a primitive species of wasp. They've been in Alaska for over 20 years, but have really only kind of started to hit the Fairbanks North Pole area really badly in the last few years.
Burr says the larval stage of the wasp feeds on birch leaves.
The wasps are laying their eggs inside the leaf, and then the larvae hatch and are feeding inside the leaf, mining it, which is where you get the leaf miner, eating the inside, and that causes those brown blotches that you see on the leaves.
Burr says the leaf damage doesn't hurt the tree. The only real casualty is the loss of normally beautiful fall birch foliage. Last week, the cruise ship Crystal Serenity sailed into Nome. Ferried in from the offshore vessel, 850 of the cruise ship's passengers took the day to tour Nome. Those passengers accounted for a roughly 25% increase in Nome's population. And for local businesses, that meant a hypothetical increase in sales. But some business owners are saying their expectations for the day weren't met. Airport pizza manager Ioso Kuchitag says she only saw a handful of cruise ship passengers stop by to eat.
We had a few customers, a couple pairs, a single, and then like maybe a group of four.
She says the low turnout was likely because there were vendors downtown. Planned in conjunction with the arrival of the ship, the mini convention center hosted the Blueberry Festival, where Nome residents and vendors from around the Norton Sound region sold crafts and displayed local culture. Co-owner of Nome Made, Kim Knudsen, participated as a vendor at the festival. Despite the cruise ship's arrival, she says residents in the community comprised most of her sales.
Even some of the smaller items, I didn't get the impression people were buying that they could take home, like smaller items of jams or jellies to take home, but they just weren't buying as much as the locals were buying.
To encourage commerce, the mini convention center was made an official stop for the tour buses shuttling passengers around Nome. Knudsen adds the tourists came in waves and by afternoon had dwindled. Crystal Serenity passenger Mark Sola was part of the morning peak at the Blueberry Festival.
I haven't had anything to eat here. I just had breakfast before I came here, so it wasn't that big a deal to me.
He says his plan for the day was to walk down Front Street and see the sights.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
AT&T is donating $750,000 to an Anchorage program aimed at helping at-risk and homeless youth graduate from high school. Back on Track is a collaboration between United Way, the Anchorage School District, and Covenant House, Alaska. Carletta Mack with the Covenant House says the money will be used to expand three programs that help older youth recover high school credits and graduate. They will begin offering night classes at Covenant House through ASD's Avail High School, create a summer school program, and expand services at North Star Hospital. There's been an Avail classroom during the day at the shelter for about two decades. Mack says Covenant House will also hire two new mobile case managers.
They'll be spending time in the classroom here at Covenant House. They'll be going to North Star. They'll also be a part of the summer school program. And so if a young person just needs some extra support, access to resources, that's what the staff will do. So we have money for transportation. We have money for food. That's all built into this grant.
19-year-old Diamond Walters moved into Covenant House in April because she was having trouble with her family. She says she had dropped out of school because she was always taking care of her relatives and wasn't motivated to get up in the morning to go to class. But soon after arriving at the youth shelter, she enrolled in a diploma program at Nine Star and began working. She says her attitude has changed.
I want to do something with my life. I want to work with cars, and I want to work with children. So I was like, I'm going to have to go to college for that. So that means I have to finish school. And now I'm like super motivated to finish school and I should be done by December.
The grant runs for 2 years and is part of AT&T's nationwide Aspire program, which aims to support students who are in need become college and career ready. Food scientists, with the help of a botulism expert, are trying to combine science and traditional Alaska Native methods to make one prohibited food safe to eat. Regulated programs under the State of Alaska Food Safety and Sanitation Program are not allowed to accept or distribute seal oil due to the danger of botulism. But how or when the neurotoxins enter the seal oil fermentation process is still a mystery. That's what researchers are working to find out. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Val Crail describes seal oil as a little bit like a heavy olive oil. He's the administrator of Utuquinat Inat, a long-term care facility in Kotzebue that falls under the Menelik Association. He says elders at the facility identified seal oil as a priority food.
For them, it's like eating butter. This is just part of their daily diet. This is what they've always been eating. And in terms of health, it's actually healthier than fish oil. So there's a lot of benefit to eating seal oil.
But because the bacteria that causes botulism grows in an anaerobic environment, or one without exposure to oxygen, traditional methods using containers like bottles or barrels can lead to contamination. The challenge is how to prevent the risk of poisoning while working with the traditional techniques. Crail says beginning last year, Menelik started looking for ways to get a variance approved to distribute seal oil. He's one of a number of Alaskans interested in getting prohibited traditional foods safe and approved for consumption, and he hopes to clear the way for other programs. The first step in the mission was to turn to regulators. Lorinda Laka, a section manager with the State of Alaska Food Safety and Sanitation Program, says the state was willing to allow organizations to serve the seal oil if they could demonstrate a safe process. However, she explains Menelik needed to reach out to resources other than the state.
We do testing, but it's usually in result of outbreaks of illness. We don't do a lot of preventative testing to help evaluate the safety of the product. So it's usually just in response to illnesses, and our labs don't have that capacity.
So along the way, Menelik got in touch with UAF's Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center, and Dr. Eric Johnson, a botulism specialist and professor of bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has a long history in researching botulism, and his lab is registered for toxin analysis. Johnson says he'll watch the traditional process in action in the community of Kotzebue, and once he understands the preparation, examine samples in his lab.
My interest is in helping validate the process from a safety perspective. For example, what aspects in this process may contribute to the growth of Clostridium botulinum and its formation of toxins, and to implement minor changes in the process that will enhance its safety.
While the Seafood and Marine Science Center is not registered to work with toxins, it does focus on the research of seafood. Associate Professor of Seafood Microbiology Brian Himmelblum explains they can study the other aspects of a seal oil sample, like what it's composed of and how much water is left in the extract.
Because that will give us an idea when things go bad, maybe that's because some of that seal oil has some residual water available, and that's where we theorize where Clostridium botulinum is actually going to operate.
Himmelblum says, in theory, the preparers of the seal oil can avoid a botulism incident if they pour off 100% oil.
But in their mixing, if they're splash over from water, or if they're not careful how they're pouring it off, maybe that's the situation, because under what we call ambient temperatures, room temperature or outside temperature, that's probably in the range where this organism can proliferate.
So far, it's all speculation. The trick, according to Himmelblum and the other researchers, is to find the solution while keeping scientific intervention to a minimum.
We know something about Clostridium botulinum and how it acts and how it behaves, where it can be found, and how do you test for it, and how do you assay for the toxin. And so if we can combine those two worlds of traditional knowledge and Western science, we might actually come to the point of, oh, now we know how we can most likely guarantee, hopefully, that there won't be a botulism incident if they follow these particular steps.
Next, researchers will observe the traditional process, and then through collaboration with each other, Menelik, and other community partners in Kotzebue, they'll decide on what they should test and how much of it. I'm Kayla Darroche.
New research reveals salmon played an important role in the diets of Ice Age Alaskans. The information comes from an archaeological dig on the Tanana. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, two University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists applied new techniques to uncover clues about the lives of Alaska natives almost 12,000 years ago.
This isn't the first time new insights into the lives of Ice Age Alaskans have come from the Upward Sun River site. Besides cremated human remains, the archaeological dig on the banks of the Tanana River has revealed some 17 cooking hearths of ancient peoples, stretching back more than 13,000 years. UAF anthropology professor Ben Potter is the key researcher at the dig, and he says he and his colleagues have previously uncovered salmon bones more than 11,000 years old.
We had to get the genetic analyses to identify what species it was, and it was chum salmon, and also the isotopic analyses to show that they were marine. In other words, that they were behaving as chum salmon do today.
The question, says Potter, was whether those ancient peoples were opportunistically catching salmon or whether they systematically and repeatedly returned to the site each season to harvest the fish. To answer that, he turned to a geochemist working at UAF, Kyung-Chul Choi. Choi drew on a recently discovered technique of analyzing long-lasting chemical residue in ancient cooking pots. Unfortunately, there weren't any pots, only hearths. Nevertheless, he gathered the unique nitrogen and lipid chemical signatures of modern fish and animal species. Then he was able to test the ancient samples for those signatures. He says Alaska's conditions helped.
In Alaska, have a very good preservation condition compared relative other area, but our study proved that the nitrogen they still preserved for a long time.
Choi says once he got the test results back, he and his colleagues ran them through a statistical model to determine just how much fish figured in ancient diets. The results, says anthropologist Ben Potter, opens a new window into ancient practices.
It's one thing to say you caught a salmon, and we could say that before. Now we could say that there are probably different multiple groups that are clustering around these different hearths. They were doing the same thing. So that's different. That suggests that they were here specifically to capture the salmon.
Moreover, Potter says the data demonstrate the practices extending across hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Choi's and Potter's research was published Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Tyler Stupp in Nome, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaskans are passionate about salmon bringing communities, cultures, and economies together. Alaskans are standing up and declaring their lives are salmon lives. Visit salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.